Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Elizabeth Power. Elizabeth is an adjunct instructor in psychiatry at Georgetown Medical Center, the founding director of the Trauma Informed Academy, and the author of Healer, Reducing Crises, which offers everyday actions people can take to recover from traumatic experiences and be more resilient in the face of stress and discomfort. So welcome to the show, Elizabeth. I'm glad to have you here.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here, Scott. Good show. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to this conversation as well. Before we get into the conversation, I'd like to give the listeners just a little background on yourself and a little bit of who you are, just so we have some context of who it is that we're talking
to. Oh, my God. I hardly know how to start this. One way I can say is, well, I came to Nashville as a shoe repairer in 1979 because I didn't think I could do anything else, because I was certain I was dumb, defective, damaged, and all that. I could say I was diagnosed with PTSD as soon as it hit the books, non-combat related. Still PTSD is the impact is the impact, irrespective of the cause. You know, the symptoms don't care about the diagnosis. I could say that I'm an anomaly, absolutely an anomaly. People with my degree don't get to teach at medical schools, but I do because of some research I did with Georgetown. And I could say that when I get really, really, well, you know, pissed off, I don't know if I can say that on your show or not, but
sure.
I'll try and keep the F-bomb to a minimum. The first thing I do is I go out and I grab a hammer and I start building something, because I know that if I don't get it out of my body, I'm going to be in big trouble. Other than that, I'm just your average little old sweet Southern lady. What can I say? If you buy that, I've got a bridge for you.
So far, I'm on track with that. So yeah. I think you're doing a good job at presenting that anyway. So before we got started recording, you... we're talking about some troubles that you were having, and you took some time off and you went out and just built a shed your yard.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting thing. It wasn't even something I was planning on talking about, but you sort of brought that up, is that that's just sort of one of your coping mechanisms, it seems going out and just building something, right?
Yeah. It's a really big deal. I mean, trauma stores up in our bodies. It takes its toll on our body. And one of the things that has been really helpful to me, and there's actually some science behind it somewhere, I can look it up if somebody gets their knickers in a twist, but basically, big muscle, that is your legs, your thighs, your calves, your arms, your upper arms, when you can use those, it really helps it helps get the trauma out of your body. Of course, we're not talking boxing, pugilism, and stuff like that. We're talking, I got a terminal mat on a few years ago. And I had a concrete sidewalk that was all different heights, and it had buckled and bowed. And I mean, it was just, and I got mad and I couldn't get unmad. And I knew it didn't have to do with the present. I knew it was about to pass. So I just grabbed a 15-pound sledgehammer and had at it, and then out and went out and rented a jackhammer and took it right up and laid another one. You need to have a list of things you can do that are big. Even hand putty will help, but anything that will let you use the big muscles that you have, whatever you have, so that you can help get that trauma out of your body, get those emotions to move on through. It's a lot better than using.
Sure, absolutely. In a way, it's probably somewhat addictive in a good way. You know, you get that release of energy going out.
Yep.
But in a way, it's also productive. If you're doing something to accomplish a goal, you're building a shed, you're fixing the sidewalk, you're whatever it is that you're doing something productive and not destructive, right?
Exactly. I'm facing a move part-time to South Carolina to be near my sister, whose husband just died. And, you know, I'm going, oh, my God, I'll be living in an apartment. I won't have a half an acre of dirt and soil and rocks and trees and things to build. What will I do? And I'm already beginning to plan, how can I meet my need for those times when I was a lot younger? I used to just walk endlessly. Well, I don't mean to be ugly. At my age, at my ripe old age, past Social Security, I don't need to be out walking in the night. Nobody really does anymore much, you know, unless you own all the land you're walking on and are pretty sure it's pretty safe and all that. But I need to be reducing my risks and increasing my ability to exercise and exorcise all the energy that gets stored up. I still go off like a bottle rocket when something goes wrong. When I woke up and found the blue screen of death on Windows 11 on my computer, and I live with my, you know, it's assistive technology for me in a lot of ways. as well as my work tool. You know, I was thinking about picking it up and throwing it across the room and all those things. I bet you know those things, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or in my Subaru Crosstrek where I think, oh God, that's really a tank and I can just drive over that and drive up over them. You can fill in the blanks any way y'all want to. I'm just going to drive over them. I'm so mad at them. I'm just going to drive over them. I don't know why they thought they could possibly get away with running me off the road or trying to run me off the road. And then I back up and I go, are you kidding me? Seriously, wait a minute. You think that that person woke up at 6:30 this morning and thought, ooh, 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 at 1 o'clock, I'm going to be on Thompson Lane in Nashville, Tennessee, going east, and I am going to be right behind Elizabeth Power. She's going to be right there. I know she is. And I'm going to run her off the road just to piss her off. Are you kidding? I have no idea what's going on for that person, but I doubt seriously it has anything to do with me. They might have spilled coffee in their crotch. They could have had a bee in their bonnet. They could have been. I have no idea what's going on for them, but I'm just certain that they woke up and decided to take that out on me, whatever it was. You know, and it's like,
right.
I don't wake up and do that. Why do I think they do?
You know? When you put it into those terms, it seems absolutely ludicrous. Nobody thinks
it is.
That. Nobody,
it is. You know? It is ludicrous. Maybe 2% of the world, of the people in the world, wake up deciding to be real jerks. Maybe 2%. They can't all be in my neighborhood. And they don't all know where I live and what my routine is.
And they don't, I guarantee they don't take the same route to work every day.
Or
to the grocery store, or to wherever else
you
go.
You know, and my route to work is essentially 12 steps east in the house, you know. But when I go to the grocery store or somewhere else, you know, and when I hear something that sounds like gunshots in my neighborhood, and I instinctively think, okay, is there a line of sight? What's the line of sight on that? Where's that coming from? I think, who in the heck does that? People who've been shot at.
Right.
You know, and it's like, okay, there's no direct line of fire. Oh God, my neighbor just got a gun. There's a direct line of fire, but that's not close enough to be her. So, oh wait, that's probably somebody's got one of those mufflers on their little tiny poot car. That sounds like an AR and AK. Do people make those things? And I'm thinking, they're doing that just to get my stuff up. I'm thinking, no, they're not. But when the cable for the Comcast across the street, I'm on a different provider, was severed by a bullet, I thought, you know, it might really be time to move. So
that is true. Yeah, that's a good thought.
Process of assessing what risk, what is a real risk and what is a risk that I'm making up that's left over from something else I've experienced. Somewhere else in this country or in this world where it's extremely hot, if you get my drift.
No, absolutely. And so on this podcast, I try to bring on guests with different perspectives, different methods of maybe treating various issues, even different just points of view on how they approach things. And I love how you brought that up. You know, people don't generally wake up thinking to themselves, okay, I'm going to go at 1 o'clock this afternoon and just totally ruin this person's day. Generally, that's not the way most people operate, right? And that's a great perspective to have. Unfortunately, sometimes we don't think about things in that manner, right? But generally, I try to have people on the podcast like yourself who have different ways of dealing with these issues that the listeners may be going through. And
thanks,
And I want to talk about the Trauma Informed Academy and the work that you do through there, because it seemed really interesting to me in how you are approaching care for traumatic experiences.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that. I mean, first of all, if you think, and this is a big general question, it's designed deliberately to diffuse some of the energy around trauma. If you think about a traumatic experience as anything that is so overwhelming that you think you might die or lose your mind or be badly injured, can you name me one person who hasn't had something like that happen to them?
I mean, maybe a newborn baby, but outside of that.
I don't mean to be ugly, but I think squeezing through the birth canal is a piece of cake. You better think several times again,
that's
buddy.
That's true.
I've that never seen true. One want to go back in and come out and do it again. You know, whether it's medical or natural disaster or combat or crime related or, I mean, things besides abuse and neglect and horror. This is the part that's so hard for all of us to understand because I want to be special. I want my trauma to be the only trauma like my trauma in the world. And honestly, it ain't. I got kids up the street who were once part of the Lost Boys of Sudan who love fireworks. I got a guy down on the cul-de-sac who's Vietnam era who spends his July the 4th in a closet. I always want to take him a macaroni and cheese kit, you know? And it's like, it's the same thing. We have great fireworks. So what's up with these two people who are both two sets of people, the Vietnam era guy and the Lost Boys from Sudan, who are both combat exposed, and here I am in the middle, and we won't even go into my history. You know, what's up with this really different response that they have? Well, the truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter what the name of the event is. It does not matter, because I assure you, to a two-year-old who thinks that the world is coming to an end, it's just as devastating, especially developmentally, for them to think maybe nobody's going to feed me, or they've got to have some kind of life-threatening surgery or something that to them, where they are and their body with their access threatens them. It's no different than it is for someone who's just been hit by an IED. It's no different. And that's a hard pill to swallow.
Right. And like you mentioned earlier, the symptoms that you experience don't really care so much about where the trauma came from.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And the thing is, it's not, now I'm real funny about this, and this is a long conversation. It's about what happens to us, not what's wrong with us. I don't even talk about treatment. I talk about adaptation. Because every quirk, every awful behavior that I developed and everything that I would call symptomatic of my distress, it's not something I got from a virus or an infection or a bacteria or a tumor, or it might be from a knock in the head, but there's a whole separate thing with TBI and trauma. It's because of something that happened to me. Don't make criminal behavior or difficulties illnesses. They're things that happen to us. And when we begin to realize it's not an illness that we are trying to manage. It's a set of symptoms that are adaptations, extreme adaptations to things that have happened to us. How can we tune those down and turn and change them? And suddenly it begins to be learning. It's about the neural networks we create, because those neural networks that we create drive our behavior. And powerful experiences create very strong ones very quickly. So basically, what we help people figure out is, look, okay, so I learned to duck, dodge, and hide in closets when there was shooting going on. That's what I learned. My brain sometimes forgets where I am and thinks I'm back in something happening where there was that kind of stuff going on. I need to help my brain learn to calm down a little bit and cool its jets and relax. And so I'm always looking at how can we install the good, for example. You know, that creates neural networks. And one of my good friends, Joan Borisenko, says and teaches, okay, so at least three good things happen every day. I consider this time with you a real highlight of my day. And I see your paintings, and they look like paintings that my brother-in-law did, you know, and he was Vietnam era, three tours. And I think to myself, what a great time we're having. What a great opportunity this is. This is fun. And so tonight, before I go to bed, I'll take 20 seconds, and I'll remember this one event, and I will turn the volume up on it for 20 seconds, and I will be making a new neural network. And you stack those suckers up choice on choice. And after a fashion, your brain begins to realize, wait, okay, that's a loud noise. Let's check it out before we go into fight or flight. Let's check it out before we have the old reactions we used to have. So it's a matter of slowing things down a little bit.
And taking just moments, just 20 seconds, 30 mm-hmm. seconds, whatever mm-hmm. it is, to reflect on the good that has happened throughout mm-hmm. the day, right? I mean, mm-hmm. of course, everyone has something bad going on throughout the day too. But if that's all you focus on and
that's
you dwell
a bad
on
diet.
That.
That's a terrible
it,
diet.
It is. That's,
I don't want to feed
really
that
bad.
Wolf.
Right. It's a really bad diet. That's a good way to think about it. It's like eating all the junk food constantly. And that's going to end up with the obvious negative effects, right? But if you're feeding yourself, in this case, you're feeding your mind the good, the positive thoughts and those positive memories and everything like that, then you're starting to work on a healthier way of working through things.
And it's not denying that any of that happened or that those things are there or that the negativity is present. It's additive, not loss-based. Of course, those things still happened. Of course, I still have the memories, the flashbacks, the strong feelings and all that stuff. But you know what? There's a lot more to me now than there ever used to be. It used to be all that stuff. I'm the only one who can add more to it so that I'm getting the balance back that I lost.
And it's almost, I always like having different physical examples to analogies to kind of equate this to, but it's like, if you were to take food coloring and just pour it into a cup, it's going to be really strong and really potent because it's going to be that color. But if you go fill the rest of that cup up with water, it's going to be diluted and it's not, it's still there, but it's not the only thing that's there.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And that's kind of like these negative memories, these traumatic experiences that we've had. If all we do is just dwell on that, that's all that's going to be there. And that's all that's going to make up you. But if you have some other stuff, it's going to dilute it and it's going to give you some other things to fall back on.
That's exactly right. And I think about how most of us, as we are young, and I think about generations going into service these days, most people that I know that are young, that are in service, grew up in the technology era, and they didn't really grow up with a lot of relationship stuff, except maybe watching The Simpsons, which I think is single-handedly responsible for a whole generation of rude customer service workers. Starkey's nice, but it's become our customary way of speaking to each other in business transactions. And that is the longest running, most valued show on TV. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, now Leave It to Beaver wasn't any better. It was racist and everything else. And it still modeled the civility. People didn't grab a gun and kill each other the first time something happened. You know, I mean,
sure.
The modeling's a piece of that too. What happens for us is, which is so cool though, is that as we begin to say, okay, I've got interconnections I can use. And this is one of our key things is helping people find connections. Like the pictures behind you, I see those and they remind me again of my brother-in-law who just passed. And I feel warmth and kindness and I feel good. But you know, what if I don't know what a feeling is? What if I grew up with absolutely, hey, in my family as hillbillies, I feel good and I feel bad was as big as it got.
Right.
So what else is there besides I feel good and I feel bad? Really, there's something else? How many words do you think there are for anger if you look up synonyms for anger?
Oh, my gosh. There's probably a couple dozen, I would imagine.
About 55 to 60, depending on which thesaurus you pick up. And when you begin to look at the feelings that we're afraid of, that you're afraid of, and anger is, as a woman, anger is one of those things I think it's like, people can't get angry with me. So I would just space out in the face of it. If I don't know the difference between feeling annoyed or distressed or perturbed or being infuriated or being enraged or having a cataleptic fit or a hissy fit, if I don't have some sense of what are all these feelings on this menu, I can't possibly even own one. So how do I learn those? Well, I didn't learn them when I was experiencing overwhelming experiences. I'll tell you that, because my brain was doing what everybody else's does and just trying to keep me alive. It didn't have room for all that nicety. So as I began to tinker with that, I discovered things like the research on where people feel emotions in their bodies. They're actually colored charts that are now normed and fairly reliable. And if you Google or search, where do people feel emotions in their bodies, you'll find this whole, and look for images, you'll find this whole set of images that look like heat maps. They're not heat maps. The yellow and the red indicates for a person where people felt activated, and the blue and the black is where people felt deactivated. But you can suddenly say, well, is that what I'm, what am I feeling in that part of my, do I match any of these? And so it's like suddenly my experience of emotions begins to expand in a time when I'm not freaked out. That's the thing. You can't wait until you're freaked out to practice these. You need to practice this stuff when you're calm and cool and collected, so you can call on it more readily when you begin to get upset, when something begins to hit you, and have a lot of mercy.
And it's like, you know, practicing anything. You don't go to the World Series and pick up the bat for the first time.
No, sir, you sure don't.
And first off, you wouldn't make it there if that was the case, but it wouldn't be an advisable way to do it anyways. You would need to practice in a much less stressed environment
when the pressure's off.
Yeah, exactly. When all the pressure is there, you don't want to be there just trying to figure it out at that moment, right?
You're trying to enlarge the pond. You don't wait to repair the dam or build the dam higher until it's overflowing. You do it when the water's down.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is just common sense, but because we live in a world that is oriented towards a medical model, we tend to lose it. We tend to lose sight of all the learning that we can do to balance things out. And that's where the Trauma Informed Academy comes in. After teaching this stuff for 20 plus years, people kept saying, we really want you to put your stuff together because you talk about power and you talk about issues that people don't want to talk about, but you don't talk about trauma a lot. I said, that's right. I don't have to tell all the gory stories to make a difference in them.
So walk us through what end user kind of walks through this, sure. this program. What do they experience when they go through this?
Well, the first thing is they experience a combination of text and video and downloads. And if they choose, there's training calls they can come and jump in on to find out, like, why would we teach an impact-based definition? Well, you know, part of it is because, for example, we all otherwise we caught up in the trauma Olympics. Oh, no, mine's worse than yours. Oh, no. I've got more than you. And then suddenly we're ticking off all the events that have traumatized us and seeing who gets the gold medal.
Right.
Seriously?
Well, and I always say, if you have two people who drowned, one in 5 feet of water and another in 100 feet of water, it doesn't really matter.
They're both drowned. Right, exactly. Exactly. They're both, exactly. So, you know, we stress the impact-based definition. And we talk about the origins of trauma and its history across time. In the big version in the history, we also talk about the history of care across time, going back to Hippocrates and the thousand-yard stare that we often see. You know, you see it in rescue pets. You see it in people. It's fairly universal. It's that stare that says, I can't afford to be here, but my body's left behind. Mm-hmm. You know, and then as we work through the model, we develop the trauma responsive system, which looks at the elements that overlap between emotional intelligence and trauma recovery, using trauma psychology and using sociology and education and a lot of different fields that a lot of people don't look at. And ironically, if your listeners have kids who are in elementary or primary grades, they may be taking social emotional learning where they're learning how to manage their feelings and learning how to be kind to each other. They're learning self-awareness, self-regulation, social awareness, social skills, empathy and decision-making, which are the same skills in emotional intelligence. Those which, you know, there's a lot of research out there. If your emotional intelligence is higher, you have better income, your relationships are better, life is juicier. Those are the same skills you need in trauma recovery. So we teach the overlaps without talking about diagnosis or medication, which some people really need and really have to have. And it really does make a difference for them. But almost everybody can jack up their skills a little bit. And so we work to help people jack up elastic emotions, which is about self-regulation. We work about finding connections, which is those inner connections that are positive, like tats. You got commemorative tats. You know what the stories are. Recipes, family recipes that we love. Just thinking about those bathes our brain in dopamine. Seriously. Yeah. So it's all the cheat sheet for feeling better more often so that you can balance your life in a different way. Wow. Well, just a lot of cool stuff.
And it makes sense what you're saying, too, how people who are better with their emotions, you know, regulating their emotions and things tend to be more successful, too, because. Yeah. Like going back to what we were saying before, if all that is going on in your mind is that negative stuff, the negative emotions, the negative thoughts, and the constantly reliving those traumatic experiences, there's not a whole lot of room for growth.
That's why I was sure that I'd never be anything more than a shoemaker.
Right.
You know, and have been homeless off and on, you know, across my life. But now, after a lot of work and a lot of attention, and frankly, y'all, it's really important. Be kind to your brain. When your brain acts up and says, oh my God, bad things are happening, it's just trying to keep you safe. You can have a little compassion for it and say, hey, thanks for letting me know. I got this. Everything's good. If you're going to talk to yourself, make it count.
Sure.
Don't beat yourself up. Then you have to have comfort. That means you got to either go eat or drink or smoke or use or do whatever you do, which may or may not be the most helpful tool.
Right. And in a lot of cases, those are not the most helpful tools. They tend to be more counterproductive than exactly. Having the drinking in excess tonight, it might make you feel better, but tomorrow it's not going to help the situation.
Right. You need those brain cells. You know, getting out on the motorcycle without a helmet and riding it 150 miles up and down the highway like a wild maniac. You know, getting out in your yard in the desert, in the backyard, buck naked and slinging a long neck and howling at the moon might be safer, although you could still get arrested for it.
Right. Yeah. But going back to what you were talking about in the beginning, going out and doing something productive, using your muscles, getting physical without being destructive, without getting into a bar fight, which also uses a lot of the same muscles.
Oh, love it. It's a lot of the same muscles. Yeah.
Not the best idea.
I used to be a scrapper. Yeah. Yeah. First bike was a Harley Panhead chopped and channeled.
Okay. Well, so it seems like, so this program here, by training people kind of how to deal with these emotions in a healthy way, rather than just reacting and having these negative reactions to this stuff, is really helpful. And it seems like it reduces the amount of time that someone is going to stay in that traumatized, I don't even know if that's the right term, but that traumatized state where they can't move on, right?
Yes, it reduces the time and the trauma and the cost of healing. Now, here's the challenge. I was awfully comfortable as a professional victim and a professional survivor. I knew my role. I knew what people expected of me. I knew what my behavior was supposed to be like. And it was a nice, tidy, comfortable, horrifying box. You want to talk about terror? Try getting both feet out of the boat when you think you want to walk on water. You know, I mean, the terror of being healthier was absolutely overwhelming, because it meant that I could no longer justify burning through whole villages of relationships.
Right.
You know.
And when you've labeled yourself as a victim, as a survivor of something, whatever the traumatic experience is and whatever the label is that you put on yourself, that becomes part of your identity.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to change your identity.
Yeah. And nobody will let go of it.
Right.
There will always be somebody who remembers, oh, you're the one who. Now, let me give you all the best answer in the world. If you're changing your life and if you're stacking your choices to the positive towards more productive choices, and somebody says, oh, my God, aren't you the one who? Your best answer is to smile broad and say, oh, yeah, and if you just knew the rest, that and so much more. And it kind of turns them away. They don't know what to say.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's a good response, too, because there is a whole lot more. And just like that cup of water that I was talking about before, and filling it up and diluting the negative that's in there. There's a whole lot more to all of us. There, we've all experienced something traumatic at one point or another, to varying degrees of, I nearly lost my life, to that was a really close call and it was a scary experience. But regardless of the degree of trauma, we've all experienced something. And it shouldn't define us.
No, it shouldn't. Although if you, in some ways, if you think about it, it does. I mean, I do a lot of work with faith communities as well. And every origin story is full of trauma. Every origin story, if you think about it from the point of view and the people in the story, would overwhelm them to the point they probably couldn't cope. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we're not talking about the barista said, oh my God, I've been traumatized. They made me taste lemonade and coffee. It's like, no, baby girl. You might have been disgusted. You might not have liked it. But chances are you didn't think you were going to lose your mind or be badly injured or die. There's a criteria there. And the thing about childhood is that we oftentimes might not know those things that have affected us that way. Or we might. It doesn't have to be what we all think about, which is abuse and neglect. That's a sociological artifact from when we began to call things trauma. Mm-hmm. And when we began to change labeling. You know, if you go back to the Vietnam era, that was really when we began this whole journey, because the guys would come home and it would be perilously clear to anybody around them that we couldn't deal with this as if it was a broken brain. What we had to deal with this was as if it was adaptations in context.
Sure.
And when we began to look at the reactions of post-traumatic stress as reactions that are out of context, we began to make a lot more progress. That doesn't fit well with a medical model that is driven by medication and treatment. Mm-hmm. Treatment tells us that there's something wrong with us that we have to fix, not something that's happened to us to which we've adapted and need to adapt again.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever really thought of it that way, because, I mean, quite frankly, a lot of the research that's out there is talking about treatment options, be it medication or talk therapy or whatever the thing is. But that adaptation is, I mean, it's probably a smart way to look at it too, because whatever it is that happened, you know, like there's no going back and taking that away, changing that.
Right.
And so if you're dealing with something that had happened, you might have to learn how to live with that. And again, go back to another physical example. If you've lost your leg in a car accident or something,
right,
there's no going back
and
getting that leg back, but you're going to have to learn how to live without it.
And so
in a similar way, there's no going back to the time before that trauma happened, as much as you may want to, but it's not going to happen.
And that water's out of the bridge.
Exactly. Now you have to figure out how to deal with the trauma that occurred and how to continue living life and try to live life in the best way that you possibly can, right?
How to open up to life instead of shutting down to trauma. And it's when you think about it, I want to talk about our medical system for just a second.
Sure.
Mental health people began to be part of the medical model not long after Freud came around. There was a whole big surge, and I could give you all the data, but please, in order for a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counselor to get paid, an insurance form has to be filed. Insurance, healthcare insurance, lives in the world of the medical model where there is a germ or it's a germ-based theory of disease. That has, in the case of what we call mental illness, if you have syphilitic lesions, if you have a TBI, if you've got lesions from dementia, if you've got maybe encephalitis, they could be caused by inflammation or parasites. In those cases, you need an infectious disease specialist, a neurologist, a medical doctor with specialized training who submits an insurance claim, just like the psychiatrist who prescribes medication or the counselor who does the talk therapy does. But there's it's a false equivalency because they are not the same thing.
Sure.
Now, here's the big challenge. We also inherit the impact of what happened to our ancestors. And so that makes us more inclined to different things and different reactions when we have exposure. But that same genetic propensity can also be changed because we have the blessing of neuroplasticity, which is why we install the positive. The genes that are associated with my father's difficulties in World War II or the Great Depression, or pick anything seven generations back in my family, those genes don't have to express when I do the work to change how they react and how I react.
Right.
So this isn't a life sentence, and medication may or may not be helpful, but it really doesn't exactly belong in the realm of physical medical care, but that's where the money stream is. And so you've got to look at it from that perspective. I don't mean any harm by this. It's just that we don't live in a system that is yet focused on adaptation. It's not a disability or an ability-focused system. It's an illness-focused system. I live in disability ability.
And it's just a different way of looking at things, I think. Yeah. And the way our system is currently set up, it just doesn't seem to fit in that nice box that you're talking about there.
Right. Even though trauma-informed care is legislated in a number of states and in a number of settings, we're still catching up.
Right.
But hey, you don't have to wait. You can do your own work, and it will make the work you do in therapy and with medication easier and faster. And that's the deal. Just how long do you need to suffer?
Right. Exactly. And how long does anyone need to suffer? Right. And I think anyone, if you were to ask, like, it would be zero. Like, I don't need the suffering, but
I may not know what to do instead, but I don't need it.
I don't need it. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you've also written the book titled Healer, Reducing Crises. Tell us about that book and what readers can hope to get out of it when they pick it up.
It's a cool book. It's on Amazon, and it's not only on Amazon in paperback. Let's see if I can get it. There you go. There we go. I'll send you a copy by email. It's on in Kindle. It's on in Audible, and I actually did the reading in Audible.
Great.
What readers can hope to get is an easy, comfortable, non-traumatizing conversation and set of stories about the things that most of us who are survivors do that cause crisis. We don't have to talk about what they are. We need to know what to do differently. So it presents the primary models that we teach in the Trauma Informed Academy, the three big ones: finding connections, elastic emotions, and identifying and focusing on strengths, and gives people kind of a casual look at what we can do to help ourselves. I would call it the prequel to the Trauma Informed Academy. So you can actually learn a lot, and there are a lot of handouts and stuff that are reproduced in the book, a little tiny, but they're still there, so that folks can begin to do their own work in a way that's supportive. I'll tell you this, Before I wrote the book or put the academy together, I surveyed 3,000 mental health clinicians and asked them, if your clients came to the door with higher levels of these skills, would that help your practice? And how would it help it if it would? And it was universal. It would help so much. The work would be easier for them and for us. And as much trauma as we have, anything people can do, like grabbing a copy of the book or signing up for the Trauma-Informed Academy, will make it a lot easier for them to do the work that they're doing to rebuild life and to build a new life after something difficult
happens. Well, that's great. And I think a good starting point for anybody, kind of low risk, low barrier to entry here, is getting a copy of the book and reading through or listening to the book or whatever they feel most comfortable with, and just seeing how that helps them. And even if it isn't 100% getting them across that goal line, you know, maybe that's, like you said, kind of the introductory to the Trauma-Informed Academy, and will help them get into, transition into that way of thinking a little bit easier.
Yeah, I hope so. What we found is that when folks begin to realize, you know, as far as I've come, I'm always going to have that far to go again. This isn't a race. There's nothing particularly wrong with me. I've learned to do some things that don't work. I want to learn to do some other things. When we become students, haumana in the Hawaiian language, when we become haumana of our own lives in that way, we find that we have the reins back in our hands instead of our lives having the reins in its hands.
That's a great way to think about it. Yeah. Well, Elizabeth, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, getting to know you a little bit more today. Where can people go to get in touch with you and find out more about the Trauma-Informed Academy? You already mentioned the book is available on Amazon, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. But what about the Trauma-Informed Academy? Where can people go to find out more about that?
It's really easy. My primary website is elizabethhower.com, and you can go and you'll find a link to trauma there. If folks want to go straight to the academy and what we're offering right now, they can go out to traumainformedcare.com, and there'll be links on that page.
Excellent.
Let me offer them a little gift. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, please.
If you guys want a month of free access to the Trauma Informed Academy, you can go to traumainformedcare.com/guest and sign up. We're putting that together today, and we'll give you a month of free access. Downloads and everything. Same as everybody else would get.
That's excellent. And I do appreciate that. And I'll have a link to that specifically in the show notes so that people can check that out. So traumainformedcare.com/guest. Check that out. Again, the link will be in the show notes. Elizabeth, again, thank you so much for coming
on.
I really do appreciate your perspectives and your point of view on dealing with trauma and kind of bouncing back after the traumas that we all inevitably are going to face in our lives, right?
Yeah. The cool thing is it makes for stronger families, healthier people, and more fun in the long run. It doesn't matter what the name of the event was that temporarily snatched your world. You can get it back. I promise. And I'll leave all the rest unsaid for later.
Excellent. Thanks again.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.